Hey, welcome back to the Football Dive podcast, where Liverpool are the Community Shield winners. Actually, that's not the headline this week, is it? No, England's Lionesses are European champions. That's the headline, and that's where we'll start talking today. And even more euphoria, I'm joined by both Miles and Dave for the first time in what feels like an absolute age. Welcome back, guys. How's it going?
It's good, man. Good to be back.
Glad to see you both back in action. Did you see the Lionesses? What did you reckon? I'll start with you, Miles. Felt like a bit of a turning point, didn't it, really? Wembley Stadium absolutely packed out and doing what the men's team couldn't do just a year before and actually winning the European Championships. What an amazing feeling.
Yeah, incredible. And for 87,000 people to be there to witness it, it feels like a huge step in the right direction for women's football as well. It was excellent. It was a cagey affair at times. It was just as nervous as I remember us feeling when it was with the men's side against Italy. And there were times when Germany were on top, but the Lionesses really came out the real overall winners with some real grit and determination that I think Weidman has done really well to instill in this team. I think if you remember that the last tournament the Lionesses were out there, Phil Neville in charge, this shows what a capable coach will do. They were so well organised. They were so prepared for whatever Germany had to throw at them. And I think Weidman's changes really helped control the game. It was scrappy, don't get me wrong. There were yellow cards flying everywhere. And I think having the experience of someone like Jill Scott come on, who I think was in a final 13 years ago, again, yesterday, she was absolutely fantastic. Got a bit of a soft spot for her time at Villa last year as well. But just the quality of the game yesterday was so good to watch. And the fact that it means so much to not only those players, but everyone in England that was watching it. And a huge step forward in women's football in this country, considering it's not that long ago since they were under a 50-year ban. It's fantastic that they've managed to win a major tournament. And With the first goal in particular that was just so classy, and the second goal bringing on such an iconic celebration, it feels like a brilliant, brilliant step forward, definitely.
Yeah, I think every step of the way of the final, and to be honest, the whole journey to the final as well, it's felt like something in the water is meant to happen for this team. And it's just absolutely insane to think of the impact this is going to have on the women's game. My daughters were watching it with me back home, and yeah, they were absolutely off their seats. To see a Wembley Stadium as full as it was, to see, 17 million viewers back home as well, watching it on telly, that's kind of the numbers you see for men's games, isn't it? And to see that kind of equality and the same kind of interest in the game is just insane, isn't it? Dave, do you think this momentum can continue for the WSL and the women's game? Do you think supporters are going to go out and actually pay to watch the women's game week in, week out now? Hopefully that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, you'd like to hope so, of course. I think in terms of the actual event itself, I can't remember a women's competition having this much buzz surrounding it, particularly the women's England team. I know myself, obviously, a few of my friends who haven't really watched a lot of women's football in the past have given this a lot of attention. So I think that goes a long way to say how much, you know, attention it has kind of managed to garner, and the achievement itself is mammoth-like in terms of what it does for the game and the kind of people that it does attract. And it was such a good final, obviously on the edge of your seat kind of stuff. England obviously don't always do it the easy way, as we know. And I was just glad to see it not to go to penalties, because we know how we tend to fare in there.
Well, having said that, the players were absolutely exhausted. You know, yeah. I think they would have taken penalties in the end just because they didn't have much energy to go any further. But as soon as that second goal went in, it was just manic, wasn't it? The celebration seems like it's going to be an iconic one now. And she nearly didn't take her shirt off thinking, if this is disallowed, I'm going to look stupid. But no, it went in, and you didn't ever feel like England were going to lose that lead with a few minutes to go. They managed the game so well, didn't they, Miles, in the end?
Yeah, I think that last 6 minutes or so, the ball was in the corner for the majority of it, and they were really trying to manage the game well. And again, that's a good coach showing their team how to get it done. And it was a brilliant moment for Chloe Kelly. It's fantastic. Now, this isn't someone who is necessarily a household name or the most obvious name on the team sheet for England. It wasn't even like it was an obvious thing that she would make the squad. And now all of a sudden she has the most iconic moment in the England national team's women's history, undoubtedly. And it's fantastic. There's a lot of depth in that squad. And you think that Nikita Paris was on the bench and that's someone that we've got used to. And you've seen the evolution of this squad now and how much the talent is coming through. This is a talented squad in a home tournament. They should have gone as far as they did. But the fact that doesn't always mean as much in international football, especially in knockout football. So they've really done something here to achieve it. And I think it's lovely seeing not only the support of people at home, but then the men's national team as well. I saw Harry Kane tweeting Ella Toon congratulating her on what an amazing finish it was, which it really was. That little dink over the keeper. To do that in a final, the composure that shows. I think it's the highest attendance for any European final ever, men's or women's. And she was able to do that in a pressurised moment. It was absolutely fantastic. And you've hit the nail on the head that it's just got to mean more support going forward as well now. I mean, the WSL is so accessible to us. My wife and I have booked our tickets for Villa's first home game of the season today, which I'm really looking forward to. I mean, they're definitely going to lose. They've got Man City, typically. But it just means I can be disappointed by two Aston Villa teams in one season instead. But I do think it's important that we do get behind it now and we really appreciate the step that it's taken forward, because the standard and the quality that they showed and the passion behind it, that's a brilliant thing to capture. And the atmosphere around it is so precious to us. When you think of all the chaos that we had in the men's final last year and how the fans treated it, and then compare that to the atmosphere around the final yesterday, that's something I want in football, definitely. You talk about your daughters growing up watching that. That's what we want to foster. So, yeah, I think all of us here at the Football Diary really would encourage people to go to the WSL where possible. It's really accessible. I think it was £10 a ticket for us. Amazing. I'm never paying that for a men's top flight game.
No, but that's the thing. You talk about the quality. I don't think many fans of the men's game realised how good quality the football is at the top of the European game, especially.
Yeah.
I know the rest of the world's kind of catching up, but European teams are generally fantastic. I mean, the Germany team we beat, I've got such a good record in this tournament in particular. The Sweden team, we just brushed aside in the semi-final. We rarely beat that Sweden team. You know, they're one of the elite teams of world football. So, yeah, we can't understate how much quality has gone into this England team. And to think Phil Neville was the coach last time we were in a major tournament with them. And it was almost like a glorious failure, wasn't it, in the semi-finals there. I don't doubt if we rewound that and put Serena Riegman in charge for that game and played it again, that it'd be a different story. It's just a different mentality, wasn't it? A high-level elite coach like that coming in and just transforming a very talented team, which is great to see. But we're not going to pretend to be like experts on women's football either. But we're sitting up and talking about it now at the top of our show. So for me, Dave, that kind of sort of says where it's become sort of a bigger thing in our consciousness and football fans generally. Do you think you'll see yourself going to a WSL game anytime soon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, as we both know, United didn't have a women's team until, 2 years ago, which is quite astounding, really. For what we stand for as a football club. So, I mean, I'd love to go and see a women's game. I mean, seeing that happen, especially at the weekend, anymore, it just kind of magnifies, how huge. And it's been such a big missed opportunity, I think, really, for this country and the people that should be sort of witnessing these moments. And hopefully now this has only kind of magnified it, like you said, and identified that there does need to be more investment in, certain areas. And hopefully we start seeing more girls in particular coming up and playing more women's football. But yeah, like you mentioned there, I'd love to go and see a United game. And I've been keeping track of sort of obviously players they've been signing in the transfer window as well, which I wouldn't normally have done in the past. So, I've got two teams to look out now.
Well, that's the thing. It's the awareness of the game in popular consciousness, isn't it? And media outlets haven't traditionally reported that much on the WSL. but you'll find there's a whole podcast dedicated to it now. There's, you know, entire sort of sections on websites dedicated to the women's game, and to see the kind of interest in it that this finals generated and this tournament's generated kind of makes you feel like it's a lot more equal now than it ever has been. So yeah, wicked to see. And I just hope it does kickstart kind of an attendance surge in women's games, because the English team has always kind of sparked the imagination for the last decade, I think, in England. I think the last time we played in the World Cup in, what, 2019, I've never seen that much publicity around them until this year, really. But this is another level, isn't it? And that created a bit of a kickstart in the kind of players that WSL teams were buying. We're buying some of the biggest names in European football all of a sudden. But this is just going to take it to a whole other level. So,
you know, the exciting thing is really as well is you look at, I mean, Miles mentioned the depth that England's got.
Yeah.
Look at the likes. There's a few members in there, quite senior members, the likes of Ellen White, who you can't probably imagine will be there at the next World Cup, potentially might be as a substitute or someone to bring on off the bench. But you've got the likes of Alyssa Russo and, you know, Ella Toon, who could easily have been in that starting lineup every time they came on the pitch. You know, they offered something completely different, a different kind of dimension altogether. And how many times did we see them come on make a difference? And that, I think that should speak volume, really, how promising this England team is. It can only get better from here, really.
When you consider that we've had a lot of conversation about the fact that the Premier League has moved to 5 substitutes this year as well, Vybin showed exactly how to utilise that. Her lineup was the same for every game. The substitutions were pretty much exactly the same as well, but always changed the game in the right manner. You mentioned Russo there. She could have scored another one in extra time, but again, a great tournament with a lot of impact, mostly from the bench. That's a really nice thing to see an international team manage to do. When you look at the men's team, you often question whether Southgate knows his best 11 and whether that costs England. Well, there's no doubt that Vybin has got a wonderful attitude throughout the squad. I think it was fantastic to see. And the celebrations yesterday were just, they were incredible.
Yeah, I think when you mentioned there was consistency. You know, I wouldn't even say, I'd argue that probably wasn't England's best 11. I'd probably say Russo is a better player than Ellen White is nowadays, but
maybe
they clearly had a plan and an idea. And you looked at even the substitutes, they came on around the same time pretty much every game, around the 60th minute. So I mean, you've got to give her a lot of credit, really, that the plan's, it's worked.
I think what a captain Leah Williamson's turned out to be as well. I thought she was an absolutely fantastic example, and defensively so sound. In fact, England's defense, it's just so formidable, like Millie Bright, Lucy Bronze as well, all kind of at the peaks of their game. And it's hard to find a weakness in that team. And when you look at the bench as well, I just think the confidence that all those players have had unleashed in them by this coach is the thing that I noticed. To try a lob in a European Championship final is insane. To try a back heel through the keeper's legs in a semi-final, you know, the quality of the goals is there because they've got the confidence to try it and the freedom to do that. And I think that's one difference between the women's game and the men's game. The men's sort of players feel, I think, a lot more under pressure. I can't see someone like maybe Raven Raheem Sterling's probably the exception to this, but every other England attacking player, I think, would really feel wary about trying something crazy in a final or a semi-final for fear of messing up. And we saw what missing a penalty did to the players that missed it in the final for the men's team a year ago. I think they feel like risk is too dangerous for them for fear of a backlash. But the women's team had no such concerns about that, which was great to see. I just wish the men's team could take note from this and look at the kind of freedom they played with and went, do you know what, we can do that as well.
It's a really excellent point. And with a tournament this year, the example has been set. And what a year for English football it would be if we could back up a women's Euro victory with the men performing well in the World Cup too. And that atmosphere around the Lionesses camp does remind me of the attitude that England players take on to their international duty on the men's side as well. And it was really interesting seeing them link the two and seeing both teams kind of training together at times. I know like Phil Foden's been doing a lot of training with the women's team over the summer as well. They've been linking up a lot. And I like the idea that the national teams have got that unity. And what better example could you follow than like you say, the freedom that the women's team has just played with. It was brilliant to watch.
So congratulations to the Lionesses. It's hopefully the start of a new era for women's football in this country, definitely. And we'll try and be part of that, I think, to do our bit to raise the game as well. I think this podcast could do a lot more to talk about women's football now. So look out for that, hopefully. But moving on to the only real men's highlight we've had so far is the start of the Football League season, obviously. But the Community Shield is the big one, really, the curtain raiser for the Premier League sides. And it wasn't a disappointing game at all. It was quite an exciting end-to-end, anything but a friendly kind of game, really. And two brand new strikers on the pitch, Darwin Núñez coming off the bench and Erling Haaland, both adding a very different dimension to each of those teams who are pretty well established as well. So fascinating to watch. Miles, what was your takeaway from the game?
I think it was a very good Community Shield. You often see those games kind of be a bit of a slog and then 0-0, but Liverpool and Man City kept their normal competitive nature and that really helped. One team was a lot further along in their development and obviously a lot further through their pre-season than the other. And that showed. Liverpool weren't perfect. They looked sloppy at times in certain areas, but City just did not look ready for it. And particularly with a change in system, like you mentioned, it was so clear that they had just gone a year without playing with a number nine. The amount of times Haaland made a run and no one was looking for that run and the ball came across the pitch instead, that's going to be something that they've really got to identify and work on quickly. But bear in mind, the last two seasons, City have not started quickly. It's taken them time to find their stride. Chelsea were running away with it last year and then City come back and they find their feet. And I have no doubt that that will happen. But for a team that has spent a whole season without a central striker and then ended the game with two central strikers on the pitch, they didn't really look like they knew how to locate that. And that really was the difference between the two teams. Firmino is never going to be your out-and-out goal scorer like Núñez is, but at least he's still a central figure. So Liverpool knew how to provide for Núñez, and that helped. Yeah. A lot of people have talked about how great Núñez was. His movement was strong. He took his goal well. I thought the rest of the game he was terrible. He probably should have scored three at least. Where he won the penalty, he's very fortunate because he's headed the ball towards goal and it's going to cross the six-yard box. Yeah. It was terrible. And there was one where Henderson played a ball through to him. And granted, like every pass Henderson played in this game, it felt like he overhit it and didn't find it perfectly. But a one-on-one, he hits Edison instead. And you think it will take him some time to get that sharpness. But that goal is a monkey off his back. All of a sudden now, there is positive talk about him. He had that friendly against Man United where he was kind of mocked. Then he went and scored four against Leipzig, and now he's got a goal in English football. So that's a big weight off his shoulders. Whereas Haaland now feels like the guy with a point to prove. And that's probably harsh because he's such a world-class footballer. But that's how it goes in the English media with football, and they'll have to get used to that quickly.
Yeah, they're both going to fluctuate between being like world class and the worst signing of the season, aren't they? Various points during the next few weeks, I think. But interesting to see the dynamics change in both teams, Dave. I mean, they were focal points, weren't they? City struggled with that extra focal point because they never have one, like Miles was saying. But Liverpool seemed to embrace having a forward to actually find on the end of long balls, someone that they've not really had before either. I mean, there was Mane who, you know, brought so much to that team, but the dimension that Núñez brought, I thought, was it needed some work. It's not perfect. It's not the finished article by any means, but it's definitely something that Jurgen Klopp can work with, Dave, surely.
I mean, let's not pretend that this is something that's completely new to Liverpool, seeing how direct that they can be over all these diagonal balls, these balls over the top that we've seen the likes of, you know, Salah and Mane chasing through onto. They're a completely different team to what Man City are. Man City, as we've seen over the last few years, they do obviously have a different approach to play altogether to Liverpool. They've obviously passed their way through into the channel, making those runs and, you know, playing behind. And obviously, in terms of what we're speaking about Liverpool, the players they've had in the past, they've had Divock Origi, who's, you know, played a similar sort of particular role, likes to kind of have the ball into feet. He obviously will attack those balls, those crosses, and so that's something that probably Liverpool aren't obviously completely alien to, and how they're able to adjust to Núñez. Obviously, it's too early to say how good he's going to be. I think, like Miles said, he's going to need time to adapt to English football because it's going to be completely different kettle of fish to, you know, Portuguese football. We've seen it over the years, damaged, promising strikers that have come to the league and not quite being able to cut it. Like you mentioned there, I think there are probably there's a few flaws in his technical game. He's not quite. I think he's been mocked a little bit. Everyone's been saying he's the new Lukaku to come into the league, but I mean, let's not forget he's very young. He's still got a lot to offer. He will definitely score goals in this Liverpool team just for the sheer amount of chances that they create. Let's not forget how good they can be. But I do think he's going to be a different kind of player to Haaland. We've seen how good technically Haaland is. I've got any worries about him.
Yeah.
Obviously, especially being a United supporter, I wish I did have worries about him. But he guarantees goals. They'll both score goals, but I just, you know, they're different. They're different strikers. It's exciting to see the next month or so. See how they start and begin the campaign.
I think the Premier League's a much better league for having them in, especially Haaland, who's just one of the best, isn't he? But I don't think this game's indicative of what we're going to see too much from them at all. And I think it's hard to read into the Community Shield generally, isn't it, as a kind of an indicator of how the season's going to go for the two best teams by far in the league. I suppose that leads me on to my question for you, Miles. Does this pull them further away, having these players? We haven't seen some of the players that they've signed yet. Calvin Phillips, don't know what dimension he's going to add to City as well. But I thought they did look a cut above. Like, there was a different dimension there that needed some polishing, but it's evolving the teams further. They're not sticking to the same tried and trusted script anymore. Guardiola's going for a player he doesn't normally go for. Same with Klopp to an extent, both very young as well. What, 22, 23? How much do you read into this? I mean, it was weird as well. It was at the King Power Stadium, wasn't it? So that felt like a different occasion as well. But what did you read into it, if anything?
There were definitely some key takeaways for me on the game on where both sides need to develop. As you said, we've seen Guardiola kind of clash with number nines before and not really operate with them in the way that you would expect. So it will be interesting to see him adjust to having such a focal point in attack and someone who is a world-class superstar already, even if he is as young as he is in Haaland. I think it's funny because there's been a lot of talk on the two number nines, but not much talk about the one who did score for Man City. I thought Julian Alvarez looked really, really good when he came on. He took his goal well. It was a good striker's instinct. And he could be a massive part for Man City's success this year. I think it sounds odd to say, but seeing Man City line up, tactically they need to change, but their squad is ready for this season, definitely. They won't need much more business. Maybe a left back if they're looking at Cucurella. Liverpool, on the other hand, I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who's a Liverpool fan. Unfortunately, I am friends with Liverpool fans, even if I try and avoid it. And one thing that I really took away from this game was I just did not think their midfield looked up to it in certain times. Thiago is a fantastic player. Fabinho is a fantastic player. It looked a step above Henderson, in my opinion. And the other thing that really stood out to me was the same old argument that we have all the time at how poor Trent Alexander-Arnold is defensively. Either, if you can, Mike, insert the video into this or we'll put it on the Twitter or something and just watch Trent's defending for City's goal. It is absolutely shocking. He loses the run of Foden in the first place, then covers the goal line, but thinks it's offside, so literally stops playing and turns his back on the play. While Adrian is fighting for the ball with Foden, Alexander-Arnold's not even looking, and then all of a sudden the ball's in the back of the net. Because he doesn't have a defensive instinct. What he does have is an incredibly creative instinct. That's what Liverpool are missing in their midfield right now. It seems so obvious to me that at some point in his career, if Liverpool can bring a new right back in and make Trent Alexander-Arnold Jordan Henderson's replacement as a deeper lying playmaker, that will benefit everyone. I cannot see how he's not there already. If you look at what he can contribute from a right back position attackingly, give him the freedom to stay forward and do that. Don't rely on him to come back and defend an attacking winger, because that's where they're going to get caught out. It happened in the Champions League final and it happened in this game. Fortunately for them, they scored three times and that was enough to kind of get rid of that mistake. But I just think that for Liverpool now, they've really got to focus on how they improve that midfield and whether Trent is good enough defensively.
There's the Trent one's interesting, yeah. The Trent one's an interesting one because, yeah, if you put a highlights reel together of his defensive misjudgments, let's call them, there are quite a few, and they seem to appear in these big games more often, don't they? And I think it'd be interesting to see how Liverpool got on without the centre-backs they've got, because they've saved their skin so many times, haven't they? And they've got good reserve centre-backs as well. I think Klopp recognises that the midfield's poor as well for that reason, and that's why he's got such good centre-backs to kind of make up for that. But do you concur with that, Dave? Do you think Liverpool look weaker in midfield? Trent is the obvious weak spot going forward for attacking teams. How would you get at Liverpool if you were challenging them?
Yeah, it's something we mentioned in one of our transfer podcasts the other week, wasn't it? I said that Liverpool do need to invest in that. They just lack. I agree with Miles. I think in terms of Trent, we've seen Southgate toy with him in midfield before, haven't we? I think he's played him in midfield. Which kind of makes sense, really, with kind of that's without speaking too much about England, the wealth of options that they have at right back for the likes of Reece James. Having Trent in a midfield position would probably work really well. And if Liverpool were to go into the market and obviously buy a fullback, it might be a masterstroke for them, really. When you look at kind of the lack of options they have in there, they've got a few midfielders are quite injury prone as well. It seemed to, over the last year or two, they don't really seem to have all of them there together. A few of them have missed quite big chunks of the season, and obviously that's not beneficial to them at all. So I agree. The scary thing is that Man City have, they've bought Calvin Phillips, they've got Julian Alvarez in and Haaland. It almost seems we forget about that business that they've done. But almost like done it really quietly, and there's still opportunities there for them to further invest. Obviously, there's murmurs around Bernardo Silva potentially going to Barcelona and more again today. So it's scary to think like what they could actually go out there and get as well as what they already have. And it's going to be difficult for those teams at the top that have got to compete with.
I think the fact that they've sold willingly the players they've sold as well to direct rivals, which we've mentioned before as well, is such a flex about their strength in depth, isn't it? It really is. But they've quietly gone about replacing them, and their net spend is going to be pretty minimal. The fact that Haaland only cost what he did is means that their budget is not going to be impacted hardly at all. So financial fair play is no longer a question because they've offloaded some expensive wages as well. So yeah, smart business by City that's kind of gone under the radar a bit, and they've got stronger without us even realizing it, which is crazy to think with the players they've lost. But transfers, staying on that subject, Miles, I'm going to go to you because I know what you're going to say. Transfer news this week that's really stood out. Give us your bit, give us your take. It's got to be Paulo Dybala, surely.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's been happening for the last couple of weeks, but watching his unveiling and then him get an assist against Spurs in the week as well, it's just fantastic. He's someone that really encapsulates what Rome wants in a footballer. And he's creative. He's a flair player. He's a big name. And you saw how the fans responded. And
insane.
This really could be the kind of Mourinho second season joy that we've seen a few times. And I'm really looking forward to it as long as the third season doesn't follow as well. But no, Roma have done fantastic business without actually spending too much. It looks like Wijnaldum's going to join him there now as well. They're still talking to Andrea Belotti as a backup for Tammy Abraham if Shmorodov moves on. It's some great, great business. They brought Matic in, which you might laugh at as United fans, but he's going to do a good job for Mourinho. You know that. And in Serie A, it's the right sort of pace for him. And as things stand, they're keeping hold of all their big players from last year, Pellegrini, Zaniolo and Abraham. So that's fantastic. Adding Dybala to that squad is absolutely amazing. I'm really excited to see what he does for Roma and where he fits the system. Because he likes to play just behind the striker, which is kind of Zaniolo's spot. And Pellegrini also likes to get forward as well. So it'd be very attacking for Mourinho to play all three behind Abraham, but he did it against Spurs. So we'll see what system he lines up with.
Mourinho turning over a new leaf, isn't he? He's getting this new lease of life in Rome and he's suddenly stacking with a talented attacking team. It's insane.
Loves it.
And Nemanja Matic and Gigi Wijnaldum as well, which balances it out nicely. But no,
maybe Eric Bailly.
maybe Eric Bailly. Yeah, I mean, good business all around. I think where else in Serie A is looking like they're going to be strengthening so far this season, Miles? I haven't seen a lot of what teams have done. I've seen Napoli sort of sliding slightly, but who's actually improving?
I'm a bit worried about this, if I'm totally honest, because I haven't seen much improvement across the league. A lot of players are starting to leave again. I mean, if you look at Juventus, they've brought in Angel Di Maria and Paul Pogba. Pogba's now confirmed that he's going to be injured for at least 2 to 3 months. And Di Maria is obviously ageing. And then they sell De Ligt, which is a really frustrating one. It looks like they're also in the process of cancelling Aaron Ramsey's contract. They haven't decided whether Morata's coming back or not yet. So Juve have got a lot of gaps to fill. And Chiesa's still injured. So that looks a worry. AC Milan have talked about a lot of business, but we've not seen a lot of it happen yet. Mm. Obviously, they've brought Origi in, but there's still talk of Hakim Ziyech. That's not happened. I wonder whether that will by the end of the window. Inter Milan, probably the biggest winners. They got Lukaku back, but they've signed Mkhitaryan as well.
Mm.
But doing that stopped them from signing Dybala and gave him to Roma, basically. Which I've seen a lot of Roma fans praising Edin Dzeko for refusing to leave Inter Milan after joining them from Roma, meaning that they couldn't sign Dybala and Roma did. So it's been nice. And yeah, like you say, Napoli, they've still got players to hold on to. Victor Osimhen looks like he's probably going to stay now. But they've lost Insigne and they've confirmed Mertens has left now. So there's a lot of work to be done in the league. But that really... The exciting thing for me is I genuinely think that opens it up for Mourinho to try and have a title charge this year.
Wow,
which would
thought?
Be incredible for Roma if they could even be in the conversation this year.
I think winning silverware last season has really helped the momentum, hasn't it? So you never know.
Yeah, definitely.
Dave, any transfer business closer to home that you've seen that stood out for you? Any rumours still happening that you think are going to change the game at all?
Not
really, is there? It's pretty quiet.
Yeah, it's been quiet. I mean, I'm still obviously keeping a close eye on United and wondering what they're going to do. I mean, the fact that it's been left until, you know, the last week, a week before the new season begins, and we've signed potentially, you know, one starter, maybe two in Eriksen and Lisandro Martinez. Obviously Tyrell Malacia and two starters and a backup and what we needed at the start of the window, it's just so frustrating for me.
I actually wouldn't be surprised if Malacia started games. I genuinely wouldn't be surprised. It looks like Tellez is going to leave. Apparently Sevilla are sniffing around him. I mean, you never know with Luke Shaw, but I actually wouldn't be surprised if we saw Malacia start in the first game of the season.
From what I've seen of him so far in pre-season, it looks like a really good acquisition for them as well. But it's just not an area that we really needed to address, assuming that Luke Shaw does, you know, return to the form that we saw him in.
Yeah.
In the season before last, and we obviously need a midfielder or two. Still not addressed that issue. The De Jong situation's ongoing. It's been going on for the last 3 months or so, and we lack quality in, you know, attacking areas. It looks like Ronaldo's going to stay. So, I mean, it's just frustrating, really, because we've had half decent pre-season. We got the play, obviously Ten Hag got the players in early. Looks like we've adapted quite well to the system, the football we want to play at, which is promising. But, I mean, the club just haven't really helped him in, you know, in that regard, that he wanted. Surprise, surprise. Not really.
Do you know what, though? I think with the way that transfers in general have worked since COVID, and you look at the amount of free transfers that have happened this summer that would have just never happened before, I do wonder whether a lot of clubs are waiting for the end of the window. Because all of a sudden, you're in a much stronger position. If you look at the likes of... Dybala's a perfect example. For Juventus to have lost Dybala on a free, and Man United to have lost someone like Paul Pogba on a free, clubs are going to be really nervy of letting players wear their contract down, get to January and negotiate free deals elsewhere. So all of a sudden, the last week of the window, when players like Yuri Tielemans are running their contract down, clubs can go in with much smaller fees and say it's this or nothing.
Yeah.
And you'll panic. And I think we'll see a lot. I think it'll be a really busy deadline day this year. I think I will see a lot of that. And I think Man United in particular will be quite busy. If De Jong happens, I think it will happen very, very late in the window. But I still stand by the fact that I don't think it will happen.
No, I do think we said previously that Ronaldo's probably staying, isn't he, in all likelihood. I can't see him getting a move anywhere, Cristiano. So he's an enigma, isn't he, really? He's just so driven to succeed individually that any time he wastes now playing in a competition like the Europa League, he feels like it's kind of a waste of his career. And he wants to obviously finish in the Champions League. He wants to keep playing there for as long as he possibly can. So I understand why he wants to leave, but... Are United going to continue the season with him, Dave? Or can you see them lining up a replacement now? We do need a striker anyway, really, don't we? It looks like we're putting all our eggs in Anthony Martial's basket to try and make sure that he's the leading striker. And who would have thought that a year or so ago? You know, that's mental. So is Ronaldo staying? And if so, what kind of role will he play?
I don't doubt that he wishes he had the opportunity to go to another Champions League club. One that obviously will be contending for the Champions. But it just seems as though clubs aren't interested for whatever reason, you know, finances, his age, the fact that they're going to have to pay United probably a fee because United aren't going to let him go on the free, which is completely understandable, considering they paid about 15 million, was it, last year? So all of those factors, yeah, he's going to be at the club, I think. So he will start games, let's be honest. He's still a very good, very good player to have. Lethal in, you know, around the box, as we've seen. So if we want someone to score goals, he's going to be the man for us. It would be worrying if he did go, because there is a lack of strikers out there, in my opinion, who can kind of come in and an immediate impact. A lot of young strikers, a lot of talented strikers, been linked to Marks and Jimmy Sesko from Red Bull Salzburg. So he's one, I think, they're monitoring, but yeah, it's going to be difficult for anyone to come in and make an immediate impact.
Whether he stays or goes, it seems like United should be looking for a number 9, because even if he stays, this is the last year of his contract. They've obviously got a +1 option, but by then, you're talking about a much older striker. Mm. You've lost Cavani. Obviously, Greenwood's not around anymore. So, Ronaldo and Martial are your only number 9s, right? So, it seems like that would be a really obvious place to try and do some business. Obviously, Rashford can play there, but I think we'll see him on the wing this season. I heard a really interesting take elsewhere, actually, that I wonder what you guys think about. Borja Mayoral has just left Real Madrid today. After Benzema, they only have Mariano, who looks like he's also on his way out. They missed out on Mbappe. Benzema's obviously getting older. Ronaldo wants a club where he can be a big name and get some success and compete in the Champions League. Do we see a late bid from Real Madrid to try and bring him back there? Because they haven't been linked with anyone else, and they missed out on Mbappe, so they could do with a good press.
To be fair, they might have the funds set aside that they had for Mbappe, earmarked for no one so far. You know, they've not brought in any massive, massive names, have they? So,
and worse Bale's gone. Mentioned.
Yeah.
The Bale wages are gone. The Isco wages are gone. And if you remember last year, it looked like Ronaldo was going to Man City and Man United just wouldn't allow that to happen and brought him in. Now there's a lot of talk of Ronaldo to Atletico Madrid. Do you not think that Real Madrid might react exactly the same?
Maybe. Do you know what? But he's ruled it out categorically last season, didn't he? He's like, I'm not going back there. That chapter's been closed. The Real Madrid love story is preserved as it is, in his words. So, you know, I don't think you can ever say never, but he's kind of already said no, hasn't he?
Another transfer though that I was going to ask about, because you asked me about business in Italy and then what about closer to home, a good link. So that Dave, obviously you touted someone for Chelsea and now West Ham have signed him. What do you guys think of Scamacca going to West Ham and then finally getting another striker?
Go on, Dave, you first.
I think for the money, it's actually potentially a really good deal for them. And if you're looking at the downside of it, potential downsides, if he doesn't quite acclimatise to the Premier League, he's shown he's well capable of scoring goals in Europe. sort of last season. He's still relatively young. Side, I think I wouldn't say a risk, well, potential risk, but one well worth taking for West Ham. And like you mentioned, Miles, obviously it's been a long while since they had a striker, really, a proper striker in there, who's kind of led the line. Was it Chicharito? Is probably one of the last ones that they...
Well, they had Haller, didn't they? But he didn't really cut it.
Yeah, the last one who's come in and really scored goals was probably Chicharito, and he wasn't even Porter's
start. That wasn't great.
Really.
Arnautovic, maybe?
A controversial figure, to say the least. But yeah, I think West Ham have done their homework, and for them, I think he's a real, real good purchase, and one. Let's hope that if he can adjust to the Premier League, he might be the one. He might be a one for the fancy football teams. So
thinking about it,
I think he's
built for the Premier League.
I was going to say exactly the same. Yeah, I think his finishing is fantastic as well. I think West Ham don't struggle to create chances, and he's the perfect kind of player to sort of finish them off. I think that's great business for them. Yeah, one for the future. I think he could have an instant impact as well. And the PSG were after him as well, so he's got a profile that interests bigger teams than West Ham. I think they've had a real coup signing him. I really do.
My only worry is David Moyes does not have a very good track record at managing number nines. He doesn't seem to get the best out of them very often. And I hope that we don't see a player that's as talented as Scamacca, who's really come into the big part of his career now, where he's going to lead the line for Italy, it looks like. He had a great season last year, and he could have made a big move. And he's made one to England, which I think is really an interesting step. I really hope it doesn't go to waste, because I think he's a fantastic player.
Yeah. Well, potential punt for top scorer, maybe. Who knows? Those guys are actually talking about such issues very soon on the pod. So look out for our season previews in the very near future before the season kicks off excitingly next weekend, which I can't wait for. I'm actually buzzing for the start of this new season. So many different variables, so many new players added. Yeah, it's going to be a good one. If you want to catch our predictions on who's going to win what and who's going to finish where, please do stay tuned. Please do hit like and subscribe right now, so you can see everything that we think about the coming season, good, bad and ugly, and look back at it in 9 months' time and just laugh, like we did last season, pretty much. That was fun. But I think we've exhausted all our transfer news this time, Dave and Miles. It's been great talking to you both and having you back, and great to have that dynamic back. England are European champions in something, which is great.
It came home.
News. It did come home, and the women had to do it for us. So thank you to the Lionesses for making all of the nations super proud. And roll on the new season. Thank you, guys. Take care. Right. Thanks for watching.
See you later.